This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, we can make a difference. I can't think of a more timely interview than this gentleman tonight, in light of all of the events that have happened around the flotilla, the flotillas of peace that were headed towards Gaza. Alan Hart is an author. He's former Middle East chief correspondent for the Independent Television News, former BBC Panorama presenter specializing in the Middle East. Alan is the author of several books, including the 1984 biography of Yasser Arafat, Terrorism or Freedom Fighters, Yasser Arafat and the PLO. He also has just completed the trilogy Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews, and that's part of what we'll be discussing today. His new book will be coming out this week, if I'm not mistaken. And some of the people that Alan has been friends with and befriended are Golda Meir, the mother of Israel, Yasser Arafat, the father of Palestine, people like Shimon Peres, Kissinger, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, King Hussein of Jordan. These are people that he worked and talked with on a regular basis. No one knows the Middle East or the players of the Middle East like Alan Hart does. Alan, welcome to the show, and I am deeply in your debt for the work that you do. Thank you very much.
It's great to be with you, Basma. May I make one small correction? I was never a friend of Henry Kissinger. I regard him, frankly, as one of the most evil men in the world.
I agree. I'm sorry. I thought I said that you were an acquaintance or talked to him.
No, I did talk with him once. I did talk with him once privately, but if we time later in the program, I must tell you my favorite Golda Meir Kissinger story.
Okay, absolutely. That would be wonderful. The Zionism, The Real Enemies of the Jew, Volume 1, 2, and 3, which is due to be released this week, Alan?
No, Volume 1 was published, the American edition was published a year ago. Volume 2 was published at the end of last year. Volume 3 is will be out any day now, within literally in a matter of days.
Wonderful. And I can't imagine a more timely event to put this work out, because people are pretty well fatigued with Israel and its shenanigans and its terrorism.
Well, the thing about my book, if I can just put it straight on the record here, Basma, you know about it. Its title doesn't actually do justice to the book, although I've insisted on the title. It is a rewrite of the entire history of the making of the conflict and the sustaining of it from the beginning right up to now. It's right up to Obama's surrender to Netanyahu, for example. But what is special about it? I've not only taken out all of the Zionist propaganda lies, as the events in the region unfold, I take my readers behind closed doors in London, in Paris, in Washington, and Moscow. So, in other words, you can see how all the pieces fit together. So you can start out, Basma, knowing nothing worth knowing about this conflict, which frankly is 98% of all Americans. And if you read the book, which is written in my easy reading television reporting style, you can see how all the pieces fit together, and you can make sense of it all for the first time ever.
And that is the most amazing thing. And the way you've written the book is actually, you call it an appeal to the American people.
Yeah, I've written a very first introduction to the American edition, which, as you say, is me talking directly to Americans. It's called Dear America. And let me quote the very first opening sentence of the book. It says, "Dear America, if our children, wherever they live, are to have even the prospect of a future worth having, the world needs America's best, not what it had under the neocon regime of President George W. Bush, its worst.
Absolutely. And, you know, people often will fight you on, I mean, fight me, fight people that say these things about Bush. Why is it true that Bush was the worst?
Well, I think he was joint worst with the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they were the best recruiting sergeants for violent Islamic fundamentalism. But I think there's one great error in America and my country, Britain. Blair was presented as Bush's poodle, was he not? Mm. I think that's totally wrong. I think Bush was basically pretty stupid. Blair was not stupid. Blair was not a socialist, modernizing prime minister. Blair was a neocon. And I think Blair more or less made common cause with your neocons here, who are both neocons and Zionists in many cases. And I think, you know, they tied up with Cheney and the Christian fundamentalists. And I think they simply drove the idiot Bush down the road they wanted him to go.
Exactly. You know, there are so many stories about, you were once called the boyfriend of Golda Meir because you sent her roses. Is that
yeah,
true?
I mean, well, let me tell a little story, how I first got to know Golda Meir. You remember Levi Eshkol was the prime minister in Israel once upon a time, and he died of a heart attack. So the Israeli Labour Party was meeting to choose which man would succeed him as leader and be automatically prime minister. And the Labour Party was consisting entirely of Jews, it couldn't agree on anything. So they drafted Golda Meir, who had been foreign minister, and she was then secretary general of the party, as a candidate to be considered. So the Labour Party is meeting in Tel Aviv, about 450 members are meeting, to have a debate and choose which of several people will be prime minister. Now, Basma, at that time I was in Israel, as well as 700 other foreign correspondents. They all decided it was no story, because who wanted to go as a foreign correspondent to sit through 5 hours of Hebrew? And they said, no, if Golda's elected, we'll just use a photograph of her and do a report saying she's prime minister. And I said to my camera team, my ITN camera crew, I said, look, there's a bloody good story here if we get it right. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it's all in the book. Golda was sitting in the middle of the hall, and I said to my camera team, if she wins, when the verdict is announced, I don't want the camera on the platform. I want the camera tight on the head and shoulders of Golda Meir. And when her name was announced as the winner, what she did, she put her hands to her head and her shoulders sunk, and she buried her hands in her head. Now, Basima, you know, we journalists, we talk about the weight of the burden of power descending on people's shoulders, right? That's what we often say.
Mm, absolutely.
Well, I witnessed this, and I was very moved by it, because Golda then was as old as my grandmother, and I thought as frail as my grandmother, about to lead this young, arrogant, aggressive nation. And I was so moved that when I got back to the hotel, I quickly wrote my story and got rid of it. And then I ordered 3 dozen roses for Golda. And I sent them with a little handwritten note saying how moved the Goy had been by what he had witnessed, this power descending on her shoulders. I thought the flowers wouldn't get to her and that would be the end of that. Hours later, I'm in the bar of a hotel, and the phone rings, and a voice says, thank you for the flowers and the thoughts that came with them. And that was the beginning of a terrific relationship with Golda. Now, it didn't make me a sycophant, because we had lots of challenges behind closed doors. It was just my English gentleman's way of being courteous, but there was a reason for it as well, because, you know, all prime ministers, all presidents, they are surrounded by people whose job is to keep the press from them. that little demonstration on my part gave me a direct line to Golda. I didn't have to go through an establishment and a sort of group of minders to get to her. But there's lots of fabulous stories about Golda in the book. But well, it was Moshe Dayan, incidentally, Moshe Dayan who coined the phrase Golda's boyfriend, because he didn't like a goy, because I am a goy.
Yes.
He didn't like any goy being a friend of his prime minister.
His prime minister, yeah, it offended him, offended his sensibilities. You know, there are a couple of things that you know, I had the great pleasure of meeting Alan, for those that are listening, a few nights ago, last Thursday, at a friend's house, Ron Eamon. They had a small reception for him. And it was a very interesting evening and very, you know, it was important for me to see. You had an altercation, and this is a friendly altercation, with my dear friend Hassan, and who is the director of the, Hassan Nawash, who is the director of the Palestine office. Hassan has also been a guest on our show. And when Israel attacked the flotilla, all I could think of was, oh my God. You know, I didn't really want it. I didn't want you to be right, Alan. I didn't want me to be right. I am a poet myself, and so for me, I wanted the poetry and the movement and the emotion and the compassion that somehow we think exists within these Zionist criminals. I wanted it to be real, but it isn't. And I think that Hassan may have been very, very disappointed in,
yes,
in maybe some of the work that he's done.
Well, I think Hassan's a good, caring man, but I think he's somewhat naive. You see, I would characterize the Israeli attack on the flotilla just as I've characterized Israel's attack on Gaza, Israel's last two wars on the Lebanon, for example, as acts of naked state terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it is that simple. But, I mean, if we want to come to the realities of why so many people are naive about what's going on, I mean, can I just put on the table what I think are the three main realities, Fatima, that
please,
have to be faced?
Please, I want everyone to hear this. These are vital.
I mean, the first is that Israel's leaders are not interested in peace on any terms virtually all Palestinians and most other Arabs and Muslims everywhere could accept. Zionism can't change. It is congenitally incapable of change. It wants today what it's always wanted, the maximum amount of land with the minimum number of Arabs on it. Yes, Fatima, it's true that under verbal pressure from President Obama, Prime Minister Netanyahu has let the words two states pass through his lips. But the Palestinian state he has in mind is the same as Sharon had in mind. It's two or three Bantustans on a maximum of 40, possibly 50% of the occupied West Bank, which the Palestinians could call a state if they wished. And of course, in this scenario, all the main illegal settlements, Israeli settlements, stay. And where are they? They're sitting on top of all the main water aquifers. Mm. So that's reality number one. The second and related reality can be summed up like this. While it's true that the incredible, almost superhuman steadfastness of the occupied and oppressed Palestinians is the rock on which all of us associated with the truth of history stand, the struggle for justice for the Palestinians and peace for all is not going to be won or lost in Palestine that became Israel. It's going to be won or lost here in America. And the conclusion invited by those two realities, demanded, not invited, is that there's not a snowball's chance in hell of peace unless the major Western powers, led as they must be by America, are prepared to use the leverage they have to cause or try to cause enough Israelis to be serious about peace on the basis of an acceptable amount of justice for the Palestinians. And that brings us to the third reality. It's why I wrote my book. It's why I'm here. The third reality is that because of the stranglehold of the Zionist lobby and its stooges in Congress on policy for Israel-Palestine, no American president is going to use the leverage he has unless he is pushed to do so by informed public opinion, by expressions of real democracy in action. In other words, for peace to have a real, and I believe, last chance, a constituency of understanding has got to be created here in America to give the president the space to take on the Zionist lobby in all of its manifestations. As I put it, Bassemer, in the forthcoming volume 3 of my book, in order to use the leverage he has to require Israel to be serious about peace, the president needs enough members of Congress to be more frightened of offending their voters than they are of offending the Zionist lobby. The problem now is defined, and I dare to suggest it in the Dear America introduction to volume 1 of the book. The problem is that most Americans are too uninformed and misinformed to do the pushing and make their democracy work. Simply stated, most Americans, like most Westerners, have been conditioned to accept a version of history, Zionism's version, which is not true. It is quite simply a pack of propaganda lies from beginning to end.
Well, Alan, one of the things that I've always found as an American that is coming to terms with the reality that our government is ineffective, certainly not addressing the needs of the people or the constituency that put them into power. And but I have, because of my this show, because of some of the work that I do, I have something that has filled that void of believing in the myth. What do you replace Zionism with? If you take Zionism and really spread the truth like you do, and the Israelis will never accept it. They don't want to hear it. You've told us that yourself. How many Israelis that you know that are good and honorable people would rather believe the myth than to find out what the truth is? How do you change that?
Well, let's first of all just look at two elements of the truth that need to be told. I mean, the book, you know, my book through its three volumes unmasks many lies, but the two greatest lies, before we come to your question, we can summarize. The biggest of all the lies is the assertion that poor little Israel has lived in constant danger of annihilation, the driving into the sea of its Jews. As I document in detail throughout the three volumes of my book, that has never, ever been true. Israel's existence has never, ever been in danger from any combination of Arab force, not in 1948, not in 1967, not even in 1973. And the fact of the matter is that it was stupid Arab rhetoric suggesting otherwise that assisted Zionism to get away with this mother and father of propaganda lies. The Arab regimes, Bassemer, never ever had any intention of fighting Israel to liberate Palestine.
Now that's Zionism, an important point. That is a vital point, because we always hear Israel had no choice. It was going to be attacked.
Yeah, well, you see, let's look at, in a couple of sentences possibly, at each of the three wars. In 1948, Israel's so-called War of Independence. Yes, it's true that elements of five Arab armies crossed into what had been Palestine and by a vitiated partition plan resolution was going to be divided into two states, one Arab, one Jewish. Yes, elements of the Arab armies came. They had absolutely no intention of trying to destroy Israel. Their only purpose, and they failed in that, was to try to hold on to the land that the partition plan had assigned to the Arabs. Now, there was a truce soon after that fighting started. It lasted 3 weeks. In it, the Arab elements of the Arab armies got not one bomb or bullet because there was an arms embargo on the region. During that three-week truce, Ben-Gurion's Israelis got everything they needed. Ben-Gurion had raised $50 million. Ben-Gurion had spent it well, and he was able to bring in all the arms and armaments needed to beat the Arabs. But this is the point about 1948. When the fighting resumed over the first truce, and I bet there's almost no American that knows this, it was 90,000 well-armed Israeli soldiers against 20,000 poorly armed, demoralized, badly led Arabs. That's the truth, Bessemer, about that war. I can speak with great authority about the 1967 war because I was there. I was the first correspondent to the banks of the Suez Canal with the advancing Israelis. Now, that goes down in history as a war which Israel had to fight either because the Arabs attacked first or the Arabs were intending to attack. That is one huge, big, fat propaganda lie. So far as Israel's hawks were concerned, it was to finish, complete the unfinished business of 1948. And let me tell you that one of my good friends in Israel is a man called Major General Shlomo Gazit. He was the best and the brightest of Israel's directors of military intelligence. And one day in 1980, I said to him, Shlomo, I've come to the conclusion that it's all a myth. Israel has never, its existence has never ever been in danger. And he was stirring his coffee at the time, and he stopped in mid-stir, Basima, and he looked at me and he said, Alan, the trouble with us Israelis is that we have become the victims of our own propaganda. And you know, when I was writing the long chapter on that war, in the 67 war in my book, I say aloud to my readers, there were times when I wanted to cry out with the pain of knowing how much Israelis had been deceived and lied to by their own leaders. Mm. It's truly astonishing. But can I just return to 1948 to make another important point?
Please do, please do.
There is a great truth there. I mean, I've said, and I think you agree, that the Arab regimes never had any intention of fighting Israel to liberate Palestine. When the Palestine file was closed in 1948, the Arab regimes shared behind closed doors the same hope as Zionism and the major Western powers that the Palestine file would remain closed forever. And then along comes this ugly little man called Yasser Arafat, and with a few friends, Abu Jihad among them, he causes the Palestine file to be reopened. And that's why he was demonized by all who demonized him. And that file has remained open because of the incredible steadfastness of the Palestinians. And it cannot be closed now unless the Israelis resort to a final round of ethnic cleansing, and my own fear is that they very probably will.
Your fear and my fear, I don't see it ending in any way. I see the arrogance of the Netanyahu regime growing even beyond anything that was ever there. Look what happened today when he responded to and said that this was a legitimate attack on the flotillas. And what killed me the most was, and was so blazingly arrogant, that's the only word that I can think of, is that he cited United Nations mandate. He said that this was legal under the United Nations. Well, the entire event of Gaza was illegal. So are you telling us that you get to pick and, they're telling us that they get to pick and choose when they can adhere to the United Nations and when they cannot?
Bassamo, there's a bottom line, and I spell it out and I give the historical background to it. There are two sets of rules on planet Earth for the behavior of nation states. There's one set of rules for all nations of the world, excluding only the Zionist state of Israel. And there's another set of rules, do what the hell you like, for the Zionist state of Israel. I still can't get over what I've seen of the mainstream media's coverage of the Gaza flotilla affair.
Unbelievable.
I mean, absolutely unbelievable. It's the old story, poor little Israel acting in self-defense. But I thought the sickest, maddest single statement I read today was actually in the Wall Street Journal. It was written by a guy called Max Boot, who allegedly is a senior fellow in the National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He in his article, he recognizes that it's a bit embarrassing for Israel what's happened, but he has this sentence, quote, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist groups are conducting a skillful information war that is making Israel a pariah state in the international community. For God's sake, Basima, what is making Israel a pariah state in the eyes of more and more peoples of nations is Israel's criminal bloody behavior.
Exactly.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and wiki spaces where you can share and collaborate? Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution, if you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economist on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
Save up to 86% off retail with ClickInks.com. I go to ClickInks.com for all my printer and fax supplies. Their remanufactured ink and toner cartridges work great. They save me money and reduce my carbon footprint. ClickInks.com cartridges are manufactured to meet or exceed original manufacturer's specifications. Save even more with the exclusive coupon code BBS. Simply enter the coupon code BBS at checkout to receive an additional 10% off. For incredibly low prices, buy two, get one free, friendly customer service, and even free shipping. Get all your printing needs at clickinks.com. Call 1-800-706-INKS. That's 1-800-706-4657. Or visit clickinks.com.
Hello, everybody. Well, I'd like to welcome our listeners back. We have with us this evening Alan Hart, author of Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews, Volume 1, 2, and soon to be released, Number 3. Hi, Alan. We were talking about the audacity of Netanyahu inciting United Nations mandates when for years, the Israelis have been defiant of all of the United Nations mandates. Isn't it ironic that they pick it up and they love the United Nations when they at one point and they hate them the next day?
Well, what is extraordinary, Basima, is the whole question of Israel's very legitimacy, so-called.
Yes.
I mean, most of the world has been conditioned to believe Zionism's version of events, that Israel got its legitimacy from a United Nations partition resolution, right? That's what the whole world has been conditioned to believe. It's simply not true, and let me tell you what the truth is, and this may be new to, I suspect, most of your listeners, even though they're informed. Yes, there was in 1947 a partition plan resolution it was passed by the General Assembly to partition Palestine after the British had made a mess of it and walked away, to partition Palestine into two states, one for the Jews, one for the Arabs, with Jerusalem not going to either, it to be kept separate. Now, that resolution in the General Assembly was postponed twice because there wasn't a majority for it. They finally got a majority by sheer blackmail. 23 American senators and powerful elements within the Zionist lobby blackmailed four countries, the leaders of four countries, into voting for this resolution. But leave that to one side. The fact of the matter, and leave aside also the fact that the United Nations did not have the authority or the power to partition Palestine and give it to incoming alien Zionist Jews. Leave all that to one side. The fact is, yes, there was a partition plan resolution in the General Assembly. The General Assembly can only make proposals. Nothing becomes effective until it goes to the Security Council and is voted upon. Mm. The partition plan resolution did not go to the Security Council. Why not? Because President Truman knew that if approved, it could only be imposed by force because of the totality of Arab and other Muslim opposition. And President Truman was not prepared to use force to impose it. So the United Nations proposal from the General Assembly was vitiated, became invalid. What happened then was that Truman instructed his American ambassador to go back to the UN, and what they proposed was that Palestine should become some form of mandate under the United Nations. Now, Basava, it was while the General Assembly was debating what the hell to do about Palestine that Israel unilaterally declared itself to be in existence, actually in defiance of the wishes of the organized international community as it then was, including the Truman administration. The fact is that only the peoples who were dispossessed of their land and their rights, i.e. the Palestinians, can give Israel the legitimacy it craves. And that's why all these years, Israel's insistence has been recognizes. I wonder how many of your listeners know what I've just told you.
Well, you know, I have heard about this, but honestly, you put it in a position where it's very clear. And, you know, again, we've heard that, you told me that Golda Meir was the one that that made the first comment about the Palestinians not existing.
Yes, she said that to me in a television interview.
Yes, and ever since then, I can't tell you how many times I have heard that Palestine doesn't even exist. And it's actually Israel that never existed, and Israel that exists in form, but not in reality.
Well, no, I would put it better in the other way. The Zionist state of Israel exists in reality. It doesn't have a right to exist. But what also has to be added to that mix is that all of the Jews, the Zionist Jews who returned to Palestine in answer to Zionism's call, had no biological connection whatsoever to the ancient Hebrews. They were Jews who converted to Judaism long, long after the first Jewish Hebrew presence in Israel. At the time of Zionism's dishonest mission statement in 1897, there were then about 10,000 Jews in Palestine. Now, they were approximately the descendants of those Jews who had stayed in Palestine through everything. They looked upon themselves as Palestinians, and they were fiercely opposed to the Zionist enterprise because they said, look, we have lived among our Arab brothers for all these centuries, really without much trouble. If these Zionists come in and have their way, they will make us enemies as well as themselves. So, you know, the whole question of legitimacy, Israel has no right to exist, no legitimacy, but the fact is, by force of arms, it exists.
Well, let me ask you this then. Being what I consider a true expert, because you've been there, you've seen them, you've talked to these people, you have lived the life within these conflicts. What's the solution?
Well, once upon a time, you know, of course, of the work of Ilan Pappy, his great revisionist historian, who wrote The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Well, Ilan and I are dear friends, and we sometimes do things together on public platforms. Ilan and I once shared the view that maybe a genuine two-state solution was the beginning of hope. That was Israel back to its 67 borders with Jerusalem an open city and the capital of two states. Now, both Ilan and I recognize that that didn't completely give the Palestinians justice. But once upon a time, we both thought that if that could come into being, over a generation or so, it could generate the trust, and in which at the end of that, Israeli Jews might say, what the hell do we need two states for? Let's all make one state. So even though I was a supporter at one time of a two-state solution, that was the logic behind it. But of course, it's now gone. There is absolutely no prospect of a two-state solution. It's been killed by ongoing Israeli colonization. And let me tell you of a quote from Shimon Peres. As I tell in my book in some detail, in 1980, I became the link man in a secret exploratory dialogue between Peres and Yasser Arafat. Needn't go into why now, because that's all in the book. But I was the secret link man in a conversation between them. And when it began, this is 1980, Basima, Peres said to me, I fear it's already too late. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, every day that passes sees new bricks on new settlements. And he said, Prime Minister Begin knows exactly what he's doing. He's creating the conditions. He's stuffing the West Bank with settlers because he's creating the conditions for a Jewish civil war, because he knows that no Israeli prime minister is going down in history as the one who gave the order to the Jewish army to shoot large numbers of Jews to get them out of the West Bank. And there was a pause, and Peres said, I'm not. But the point is this, Basima. Peres spoke those words to me in 1980, when there were only 70,000 illegal settlers. Today there are 500,000, and their number is rising on a daily basis.
And they are very well armed.
And they are beating up and terrorizing lots of the Palestinians. In a sense, there is a very, very slow ethnic cleansing still going on. But your question was, what is the solution? Mm. Well, Mersheimer and Walt argue that there may be a period of apartheid, but it will eventually end in one state. I simply don't believe that. I don't believe Zionism would ever put itself out of business. But let me just say this as a sort of hopeful sign. I do honestly believe that the Jews, generally speaking, are the intellectual elite of the Western civilization. I do honestly believe, generally speaking, that the Palestinians are the intellectual elite of the Arab world. In theory, what they could do together in peace and partnership is the stuff that real dreams are made of, Basima. They could change the region for the better and give new hope and inspiration to the world. But because of Zionism, that cannot happen. Zionism, I mean, the answer is the de-Zionization of Palestine that became Israel. The Zionists are never going to allow it to happen. And let me quote to you from Golda Meir, when she was prime minister, and this is in one of the first few pages of my book. I was doing a panorama interview with her, a BBC panorama interview, and I said to her at a point, Prime Minister, I want to understand what you've just said. You are saying that if ever Israel was in danger of defeat, it would be prepared to take the region and the world down with it. And without a pause, Basima, she says, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Now, the point is, that BBC interview was transmitted between 8 and 9 o'clock on a Monday evening. By 10 o'clock the same evening, the Times of London, then a superb newspaper, not the Murdoch rag it is today, it changed its lead editorial to quote what Golda had said to me and added its own opinion, we'd better believe her, because that's the way it would be.
So the myth of Masada is not really a myth.
No, I don't think it is. You see, what I find deeply troubling, I am here to contribute, and I hope to come on more and more tours, to contribute to what I call the understanding of Americans to make their democracy work. But there is a problem. Even if there could be created the circumstances in which an American president was truly free to put America's own best interests first and truly free to use the pressure to require Israel to be serious about peace on terms that Palestinians could accept, it does not follow that Israel's leaders would say, okay, we'll do what you want. They could say, Mr. President, go to hell.
Mm, absolutely. You know, we have a number of questions before, so perhaps we can take some of these questions, Alan,
yeah.
Alan, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
The first one is Mike from California asks, the MV Rachel Corrie is still heading towards Gaza. What do you think will happen when it reaches the limits the Israelis have set in international waters, and could this lead to war?
Well, it depends. I mean, there was a rumor that the next vessels were going to be accompanied by Turkish warships, wasn't there?
Yes.
I mean, if that were to happen, we could be in a very dangerous situation. But, I mean, I think Israel's leaders don't know what to do. A, it's a massive embarrassment for them. It is costing them a hell of a lot in terms of what the ordinary peoples of nations are thinking. But I guess my guess is Zionism doesn't know when to stop. It's now committed to what I would call madness. I mean, a question Ilan Pappy and I often ask ourselves is it A or B? Are Zionism's leaders really clever people who know they are telling propaganda lies and getting away with it? Or do they really believe the nonsense they talk? Because if they do, I think one would have to say they are deluded to the point of clinical madness. I mean, there are some people. Uri Avneri, the great Israeli peacenik, has written in the past that Israel might be heading for a fascist state. I think that's the wrong terminology. The word I use, and I noticed Norman Finkelstein used it the other day too, but I've been using it for some time, Israel's a lunatic state.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, this is something that I've always said. If you look back historically at governments that have aspired to such atrocity as their way of proclaiming their self-identity, they end up going over the edge. That's what
they don't know when to stop.
They don't know when to stop. They have no. It becomes a matter of momentum at that point. In my own opinion, we have a question from Don in Canada who asks: you recently had the courage to speak out on the 9/11 inside job, and I'm wondering if you could briefly outline what you said.
Yeah, well, first of all, in my book, I don't go down the conspiracy road. Of mm-hmm. course, I mention 9/11 and its significance in triggering many things.
Yes.
But the reason why I left it out of the book is because if I'd put it in, I would have given the Zionists an absolute bullshot target, mm-hmm. Bullseye target, for them to say, oh, well, you see, this guy's just another mad conspiracy, and given them the opportunity to rubbish everything else I'd written. So I didn't put that in the book, but I appeared on a radio program the other day, and I was asked point blank, and I thought, oh, perhaps it's time to tell the truth. Now, what I really think is that it may well have started out as a Muslim conspiracy. That's mm-hmm. possible. But even if it did, it would have been very quickly taken over by Mossad agents within. From almost the moment of Israel's birth, Israel's Mossad and its Directorate of Military Intelligence, they have penetrated every Arab regime, every Arab military service, every Arab nationalist group, terrorist group, whatever. I mean, you know, there's lots of this in the book, and I could tell you many stories. So I think what happened, if I assume it maybe started out as a Muslim plot, Mossad would have been aware of it, that it was running. I think Mossad would have then said to the bad guys in the CIA and the Zionists and the neocons, hey, this is running. What do we do? And the answer was, use it. Now, let's not forget that even before it happened, we'd had a paper called A Clean Break, which was advice to incoming President Netanyahu in his first time as Prime Minister. And that paper was written by, among others, Paul Wolfowitz, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and Richard Pearl. They are two of the leading Zionists. In my view, they were the two prime drivers for war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. And they said, under the clean break, the strategy was, forget about peace, we're not interested in peace. The name of the game is getting rid of Saddam Hussein, rolling back Syria, and going for Iran. Also, Wolfowitz said, in order to initiate this, we need a Pearl Harbor. 9/11 was the Pearl Harbor. Now, why do I believe actually in conspiracy? It doesn't matter to me that there are thousands of experts in this country, including engineers, who've said the buildings were brought down by controlled explosions. I believe they were, Bassema, because among my own personal friends are civil engineers who work for one of the world's leading civil engineering and consulting firms. I'm not going to name it, but they did private work for me. I showed them, and they got all the film, all the footage related to it. And their conclusion was, it was absolutely irrefutable that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled explosions from within. Now, that alone is enough to say conspiracy, and you can work out from there and beyond.
I absolutely agree with you, Alan. I absolutely agree with you. And
but
it was, go ahead.
I was going to say, but what's new about covering up the truth? You know, I don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald fired a shot at John F. Kennedy. We have the attack on the Liberty on the 8th of June, 1967, when the Israelis attacked the Liberty, the American spy ship. You know, all great truth in this country, this land of the free, so-called, is covered up.
Yes. Absolutely. We have another question from a guest. I'm going to try to take this as the last one. Mary in the United Kingdom asks, what is Mr. Hart's opinion of Envoy George Mitchell's efforts in the Palestinian-Israeli situation? Is Mitchell a true envoy of peace or a shill for the Zionists?
No, he's not a show for the Zionists, but I think he's wasting his time. I mean, I've said the bottom line is that Israel's leaders are not remotely interested in peace, and no American president, even if he wants to, can move so long as the Zionist lobby and its stooges in Congress control policy for the Middle East. Mm. Now, Mitchell did a fine job in Ireland. He really did a good job there. But it isn't the same situation. It's nothing like the situation there. And I tell you why. The reason why peace came to Northern Ireland is because at the end, there was a successful campaign of IRA terrorism. But terrorists cannot work without the cover of the host community, right? That's a fact of life. Now, the British Army did not defeat the IRA. The IRA came to the peace table because the British government finally found the courage to stand up to the Protestants of Northern Ireland who were denying the Catholics their rights. And once they did that, the Catholic community then withdrew its support from the IRA. Right? Mm. That's how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you will not get support for any kind of terrorism, be it Arab or Muslim, the only way to get that support withdrawn is by politically addressing the grievance. And the grievance is A, the lack of justice for the Palestinians, and B, the American-led double standard of foreign policy as it pertains to the whole Arab and Muslim world.
Ellen, I'm going to be meeting tomorrow morning at 9:30 in the morning with Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. Now, Senator Levin is a Democrat, but he is a staunch supporter, and he is a Jewish senator who has very strong ties with Israel. He is a fair man, however, although he will not relinquish his position. What would I say to him?
Well, I tell you where I think the key to understanding is, and it is knowledge of the difference between Judaism and Zionism. Have we done this yet?
No, we haven't, and this is
right.
Very important.
Well,
this is going to go out to my dear friend, who is a Jew but not a Zionist.
Right. Well, in my view, Basima, this is the absolute key to understanding, the knowledge of the difference between Judaism and Zionism. Simply stated, Judaism is the religion of Jews, not the Jews, because not all Jews are religious. Like Christianity and like Islam, Judaism has at its core a set of moral values and ethical principles, right?
Yes.
Now, we look at Zionism as Jewish nationalism. It is a sectarian colonial enterprise which created a state for some Jews in the Arab heartland, mainly by Zionist terrorism and ethnic cleansing. And in doing so, it made a complete mockery of the moral values and ethical principles of Judaism. In reality, Basima, Judaism and Zionism are complete opposites. Now, why is this the key to understanding? Because when you know that difference, you can understand two things. Why it is perfectly possible to be passionately anti-Zionist, meaning anti-Zionism's colonial enterprise, without being in any way, shape or form anti-Semitic, anti-Jew. More importantly, and this is where Carl Levin comes into it, you can understand why it's wrong to blame all Jews everywhere for the crimes of the few. But the problem is, right now, what is happening, I mean, Zionism conflates anti-Semitism, conflates Judaism and Zionism so that it can say that all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. But that's nonsense when you know the difference, as I've explained it. But the real problem in the world today is because of Israel's criminal behavior that we are witnessing the rise, not of anti-Semitism, but of anti-Israelism, more properly defined as anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
But there is the danger, and there are Israeli leaders, and I quote them in my book, who have pointed to the fact that what starts out as anti-Israelism could become anti-Semitism if the Americans, the Canadians, the Europeans, among whom most Jews live, are not made aware of the difference between Judaism and Zionism.
And
now,
in order for you, everyone to be made aware, I'm afraid we have run out of our time here, Alan, and it just breaks my heart. I could go on forever. Zionism, The Real Enemies of the Jews, Volume 1, Volume 2, and coming this week, Volume 3.
And the publisher is Clarity Press in this country, www.claritypress.com.
And you can go to www.alanhart.com for more information.
.net.
I'm sorry, .net. Thank you, Alan, for being with us. Thank you for being a staunch supporter of the truth in journalism and media, and that is huge. It is no longer something that we have. Next week, tomorrow I will be interviewing Miss USA, the first Muslim-American candidate or winner of the title, which is quite an honor for me because she's right here from my hometown. So we'll be seeing you tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 Eastern time. It will be a special show to accommodate her really tight schedule. Alan, again, what an honor it has been for me to get to know you and to meet with you and to interview you. And well, I hope my pleasure, and if we can do some more
another time, great.
Absolutely. I'm going to hold you to that. Thank you all very much for listening. And when the people speak, we make a difference. So speak. Good night, everyone.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.